Back together, you and I, for a Thursday, January 6th of 2022, right here on Connecticut Today. We carried parts of President Joe Biden's remarks on the one-year observance of the January 6th U.S. Capitol riot. University of New Haven Professor Josh Rosen stopped by to talk about the outlook for the U.S. economy during the continuing pandemic. And a Quinnipiac University adjunct history professor Phil Gaduti shared his thoughts on the state of the nation's politics a year after January 6th.
Madam Vice President, my fellow Americans, to state the obvious, 1 year ago today, in this sacred place, democracy was attacked, simply attacked. The will of the people was under assault. The Constitution, our Constitution, faced the gravest of threats. Outnumbered in the face of a brutal attack, the Capitol Police, the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department, the National Guard, and other brave law enforcement officials saved the rule of law. Our democracy held. We, the people, endured. We, the people, prevailed. For the first time in our history, a president had not just lost an election. He tried to prevent the peaceful transfer of power as a violent mob breached the Capitol. But they failed. They failed. And on this day of remembrance, we must make sure that such attack never, never happens again. I'm speaking to you today from Statuary Hall in the United States Capitol. This is where the House of Representatives met for 50 years in the decades leading up to the Civil War. This is on this floor where young Congressman of Illinois, Abraham Lincoln, sat at desk 191. Above him, above us, over that door leading into the rotunda, is a sculpture depicting Cleo, the muse of history. In her hands, an open book in which she records the events taking place in this chamber below. Cleo stood watch over this hall 1 year ago today, as she has for more than 200 years. She recorded what took place, the real history, the real facts, the real truth, the facts and the truth that Vice President Harris just shared, and that you and I and the whole world saw with our own eyes. The Bible tells us that we shall know the truth, and the truth shall make us free. We shall know the truth. Well, here is the God's truth about January 6, 2021. Close your eyes. Go back to that day. What do you see? Rioters rampaging, waving for the first time inside this Capitol. Confederate flag that symbolized the cause to destroy America, to rip us apart. Even during the Civil War, that never, ever happened. But it happened here in 2021. What else do you see? A mob breaking windows, kicking in doors, breaching the Capitol. American flags on poles being used as weapons, as spears. Fire extinguishers being thrown at the heads of police officers. A crowd that professes their love for law enforcement assaulted those police officers, dragged them, sprayed them, stomped on them. Over 140 police officers were injured. We all heard the police officers who were there that day testify to what happened. One officer called it, quote, a medieval battle. And that he was more afraid that day than he was fighting the war in Iraq. They've repeatedly asked since that day, how dare anyone, diminish, belittle, or deny the hell they were put through? We saw with our own eyes. Rioters menaced these halls, threatening the life of the Speaker of the House,
literally erecting gallows to hang the Vice President of the United States of America. What did we not see? We didn't see a former president who had just rallied the mob to attack, sitting in the private dining room off the Oval Office in the White House, watching it all on television and doing nothing for hours as police were assaulted, lives at risk, the nation's capital under siege. This wasn't a group of tourists. This was an armed insurrection. They weren't looking to uphold the will of the people. They were looking to deny the will of the people. They were looking to uphold, they weren't looking to uphold a free and fair election. They were looking to overturn one. They weren't looking to save the cause of America. They were looking to subvert the Constitution. This isn't about being bogged down in the past. It's about making sure the past isn't buried. That's the only way forward. That's what great nations do. They don't bury the truth. They face up to it. Sounds like hyperbole, but that's the truth. They face up to it. We are a great nation. My fellow Americans, in life there's truth, and tragically there are lies. Lies conceived and spread for profit and power. We must be absolutely clear about what is true and what is a lie. And here's the truth. The former President of the United States of America has created and spread a web of lies about the 2020 election. He's done so because he values power over principle, because he sees his own interest as more important than his country's interest, than America's interest, and because his bruised ego matters more to him than our democracy or our Constitution. He can't accept he lost, even though that's what 93 United States senators, his own attorney general, his own vice president, governors and state officials in every battleground state have all said he lost. That's what 81 million of you did as you voted for a new way forward. He has done what no president in American history, the history of this country, has ever, ever done. He refused to accept the results of an election and the will of the American people. While some courageous men and women in the Republican Party are standing against it, trying to uphold the principle of that party, too many others are transforming that party into something else. They seem no longer to want to be the party of Lincoln, Eisenhower, Reagan, the Bushes. But whatever my other disagreements are with Republicans who support the rule of law and not the rule of a single man, I will always seek to work together with them to find shared solutions where possible. Because if we have a shared belief in democracy, then anything is possible. Anything. And so at this moment, we must decide, what kind of nation are we going to be? Are we going to be a nation that accepts political violence as a norm? Are we going to be a nation where we allow partisan election officials to overturn the legally expressed will of the people? Are we going to be a nation that lives not by the light of the truth, but in the shadow of lies? We cannot allow ourselves to be that kind of nation. The way forward is to recognize the truth and to live by it. Many Republicans who fear his wrath is that the insurrection in this country actually took place on Election Day, November 3rd, 2020. Think about that. Is that what you thought? Is that what you thought when you voted that day? Taking part in an insurrection? Is that what you thought you were doing? Or did you think you were carrying out your highest duty as a citizen and voting? Former president's supporters are trying to rewrite history They want you to see Election Day as the day of insurrection. And the riot that took place here on January 6th as a true expression of the will of the people. Can you think of a more twisted way to look at this country, to look at America? I cannot. Here's the truth. The election of 2020 was the greatest demonstration of democracy in the history of this country. More of you voted in that election than have ever voted in all of American history. Over 150 million Americans went to the polls and voted that day. In a pandemic, some at great risk to their lives. They should be applauded, not attacked. Right now, in state after state, new laws are being written, not to protect the vote, but to deny it. Not only to suppress the vote, but to subvert it. Not to strengthen or protect our democracy, but because the former president lost, instead of looking at the election results from 2020 and saying they need new ideas or better ideas to win more votes, the former president and his supporters have decided the only way for them to win is to suppress your vote and subvert our elections. It's wrong. It's undemocratic. And frankly, it's un-American. The second big lie being told by the former president's supporters is that the results of the election of 2020 can't be trusted. The truth is that no election in American history has been more closely scrutinized or more carefully counted. Every legal challenge questioning the results in every court in this country that could have been made, and was rejected. Often rejected by Republican-appointed judges, including judges appointed by the former president himself, from state courts to the United States Supreme Court. Recounts were undertaken in state after state. Georgia, counted its results three times. With one recount by hand. Phony partisan audits were undertaken long after the election in several states. None changed the results. And in some of them, the irony is the margin of victory actually grew slightly. So let's speak plainly about what happened in 2020. Even before the first ballot was cast, the former president was preemptively sowing doubt about the election results. He built his lie over months, wasn't based on any facts. He was just looking for an excuse, a pretext, to cover for the truth. He's not just a former president. He's a defeated former president. Defeated by a margin of over 7 million of your votes in a full and free and fair election. There are simply zero proof the election results are inaccurate.
Right now, we'll shift gears back to the pandemic for a moment or two. Not so much the medical stuff, but the economy. Everything is still expensive out there. Did you see what the beef prices? Gasoline is still up there. Talking about higher energy prices this winter here, whether you use, you know, oil or natural gas or propane or whatever. A lot of folks were wondering when this whole thing will back down. If it's going to back down, how long it might take. Joining us right now is John Rosen. He's a professor at the Pompeia College of Business at the University of New Haven, the economics department there. Going to talk a little pandemic economic issues with us. He's, by the way, the co-author of Stopwatch Marketing, Take Charge of the Time When Your Customer Decides to Buy. Sounds like it makes sense. See, I'll never write a book. And again, here's another guest whose business card is far better than mine. John, hi, it's Paul at WICC. How are you today?
Very good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, John. John, a lot of these economic indicators we see mid-pandemic here, they seem to be bouncing back and forth a little bit, and every talking head we see now has a projection, a guess. on inflation. It's going to get worse. It's going to get better. The Fed says one thing. Wall Street says another thing. Give us a primer on this. What do you think is going on, and where do we stand right now after almost 2 years of this?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
I would say that the short answer to your question is exactly what you said. A lot of things are bouncing around. There is lots of uncertainty. Anybody that tells you they really, really know what the inflation rate is going to be 8 or 12 months from now, or they really, really know what the unemployment rate is going to be 8 or 12 months from now, doesn't have any better idea of what those numbers are going to be than they do of whether or not we're going to have another breakthrough virus variant, which is only one of many wild cards that will affect the economy. So I have my own personal estimates for what those things are going to look like, both in Connecticut and nationally. But I don't know any more than anybody else. You know, are we going to have three more surges, or is it all over in 3 weeks? Just, and that's just talking about the virus, not supply chain problems or employment problems or inflation or anything like that.
So what do you think, John? I mean, go ahead. We won't hold you to it. I'm not putting any cash on this. but from where you are, what do you think?
Fair enough. So I think that on the inflation front, we're going to be dealing with concerning inflation for a few years, actually. I don't think this current round of inflation is the kind of thing that goes away in 6 months. The word the Fed kept using for a long time was transitory. Inflation rarely is transitory for reasons I can get into, but very, very quickly, if prices start going up, then workers start demanding more wages, right? So employers have to raise prices, and it creates a vicious cycle, and I don't see that going away in the near term. That said, inflationary eras can be prosperous if the inflation doesn't get out of control. And in fact, one of the things that contributes to inflation is everybody has a job, so they have money to spend. Mm. And right now, the unemployment rate nationally is historically very low. And I expect it to stay that way for a while. People have a lot of pent-up demand coming out of the pandemic. People want to get out and spend money. They want to get on airplanes. They want to take trips. And one of my best friends was almost in tears over Christmas. He said, I realized I hadn't seen my daughter for 2 years.
Wow.
And, you know, people want to get out and spend the money now, and they will continue to do that.
John Rosen is the guest, professor at the Pompeia College of Business and the Economics Department at the University of New Haven. John, hang out for a minute. We'll be right back with you. More from John Rosen. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And a couple more minutes with John Rosen, MBA, from the Pompeia College of Business and the Economics Department at the University of New Haven. When is all this economic uncertainty going to go away? If it's ever going to go away, inflation, prices, and all that. John, a lot of folks hear, you know, the stuff that we're talking about right now, and they try to soak it in. There's more financial news available now than there was 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. And a lot of people, John, who aren't really into it, you know, their eyes kind of glaze over, and they say, well, all this is good, but when does my gas get cheaper? When does when am I going to stop paying $20 for steaks? And I guess you're saying that's just tough to figure, huh?
Well, it's certainly tough to figure, right? Think about it. If I could figure it precisely, I wouldn't have to talk to you today. I'd be a billionaire by working in the commodities market, right? that said, the best thing to do as an individual homeowner, consumer, is not to worry too much about swings and things like gas prices or food prices. They're going to happen and you can't control them. Some of the best things to do are things like save money, all the stuff, you know, we were supposedly told when we were young, right? Save money, pay off your credit card bills, things like that, so that when times are tough, when gas does double, you have it to buy gas, right? And when times are good, sock some of it away and make sure your credit card bills are paid down and things like that. You will go crazy as an individual, right? As a homeowner, as an everyday person just trying to make ends meet, like presumably you and I are.
Mm-hmm.
You'll go crazy if you try to predict, I don't know, this is the month to buy X because I think it's going up, or this is the month to do something else because I think it's going down.
Mm-hmm.
You will be wrong more often than you're right.
Yeah, I guess you're right, because if we weren't, if that axiom wasn't true, we'd both be billionaires here. John Rosen, the guest from the University of New Haven. John, I did read a couple of articles yesterday and the day before that there are some people in the Biden White House who say, well, maybe another stimulus, maybe not a big one, but a targeted stimulus check. This would be, I think, the third or fourth one. Is that a good idea, do you think, or not? Because I know there are people saying, well, you know, they may have put too much money in the system as it is. What do you think about that?
The short answer is, I think it's a bad idea. The classic definition of inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. Pretty straightforward, right? More dollars, fewer goods, the price of the goods goes up. So were the government to inject more money into the economy, that would likely drive inflation higher, almost certainly. That was, by the way, the reason we had stimulus checks during the 2008 Wall Street crash, because everybody was worried that the price of everything was going to go down. So as a general policy recommendation, and what you've asked me, I would say, no, the government should not stimulate again. Now, from a politician's standpoint, mm-hmm. if you really can target the stimulus to people who are really in need, that would certainly be helpful to the people in need. I'm skeptical that the government can be that, you know, precise, accurate, and competent. But, yeah, and we do a lot of things. We send a lot of money out in this economy to people who, one way or another, can demonstrate mm-hmm. need because of poverty, or they need a school loan or health care or whatever. But to blanketly throw out more money could only lead to more price increases.
John, final question. I'm going to put you now magically in the Oval Office with President Biden. You're staring at the president. You two are having a nice chat. And not so much from an epidemiological standpoint with COVID. We're not going near that. But for the immediate and future economy, John, if Mr. Biden leans across the desk and says, John, what do you think? What would you advise me to do? What's one thing I could do here? What would you tell him?
I would tell him to trust the individuals in this country, the taxpayers in this country, and the local municipalities and states. There's not much at this point left for the federal government to do. The federal government is too big and too blunt an instrument. And I would say, trust the people in your country.
John Rosen, MBA from the Pompeia College of Business, the Economics Department at the University of New Haven. Check out his book, Stopwatch Marketing, Take Charge of the Time When Your Customer Decides to Buy. Sounds like good advice. John, be good. Thank you. And we'll talk down the road. Stay safe. Thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. John Rosen there. All right. MBA, University of New Haven. Look, we seem to be as divided as ever. How is history going to treat this? Joining us right now is Phil Gadudi. He is an adjunct assistant professor of history at Quinnipiac University to talk about all this. Phil, it's Paul at WICC. How are you? Good afternoon.
I'm well, thank you. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Well, Phil, thank you. I appreciate the time. We're a year out of this, Phil, and there are two or three investigations going now. One, a high-profile one shared by the Democrats, the FBI, and the law enforcement agencies. They've been doing this for at least a year. I'm going to be interested to see what they come up with. But from a history point of view, from your expertise and where we are right now, Phil, I'm not sure a whole heck of a lot has changed. And if everything, we seem to be, especially when this subject comes up, Phil, we seem to be, at least people seem to be, you and I looking at it from afar, there seems to be even more entrenched opposite views on this than ever before.
I completely agree with you. When you look at history and you understand the narrative of history and where different events fit into how we understand those narratives and what happens and why they're relevant, what happened a year ago is really part of a larger story about how this nation has been divided for some time. And I think if you take that event and you put it into the context of all the situations that were leading up to it, you start to get a better picture as to what's going on in this country. And I look at it and I think of the events leading up to the Civil War certainly come to mind. Events such as the caning of Charles Sumner, which actually happened on the floor of the Senate, the raid on Harper's Ferry. These are major events that happened that the nation understood that we were divided. And if you look at what happened a year ago, it truly marks what's going on. And I think we still don't know what it means yet, because I think we're still in the throes of that, just like you said.
And Phil, you know, when I talk about this a lot on the show, this all does, when you whittle it down and peel the layers of the onion or whatever fruit or vegetable we happen to be peeling at the time being, when you get right down to this, these actions happen, Phil, because of attitudes of people, their life experiences, where they live in the country. So it really isn't easy to diagnose or to pinpoint, isn't, specifics about this?
No, it isn't. When I look at it as a historian, so I look at the event, and you talk about the peaceful transfer of power, something that's a hallmark of a republic, going all the way back to the election of 1800, where the Democratic Republicans took over the government from the Federalists, what Jefferson called the truly great thing of the American Revolution, that we were able to do something like that. And I see that as something that needs to be maintained in a republic. I mean, it was Ben Franklin who, after the Constitutional Convention, when they asked, what sort of government do you have? And he commented, a republic, if you can keep it.
Yes. it's a famous line. Yeah.
Which is a really important moment, I think, when you consider where we have, you know, come as a country. And I think we still have a lot to learn about what happened last year. But I mean, look, that's the first time we've seen the Capitol breached like that.
Yeah.
Since the War of 1812, since the British burned it in August of 1814.
And you would have thought, and Phil Gadudi is the guest, by the way, an adjunct assistant professor of history at Quinnipiac. You know, one thing, Phil, that really shook me from that day, before we get into all the politics of it and this and the other, one thing, Phil, and I'm sure it must have frightened you, is like I'm watching that going, where's the security? I mean, I know the Capitol Police exists, but, you know, did they not think, Phil, this could ever happen? I guess not. And maybe one of the things we get out of all these investigations, Phil, is why physically was this relatively easy to happen? It boggles my mind still.
Well, that's a good question, and that's certainly something that hopefully will be answered in time. I know for me, I've been to the Capitol on several occasions with students. So when I saw those images in the Rotunda and Statuary Hall,
yeah,
I remember taking my students there, and I see the Capitol as a symbol, and it's a very important symbol of our democracy. When Lincoln, when he was inaugurated the first time, the Capitol Dome wasn't completely finished, so he took the oath in front of a half-finished a dome.
Mm-hmm.
And his big thing was he wanted to continue building it. And he said that if the people see the Capitol going on, it's a sign we intend the Union shall go on. And that's an important piece of his vision to maintain the Union and maintain the Republic. And I think that, in addition to all of what we're hearing on TV and what we're seeing, we can't forget what it symbolizes. And certainly for my students, when I bring them in to the Capitol, that means something to them. And it certainly has meant something to a lot of Americans throughout American history.
And Phil, you know, and again, you probably use it. I use it. Businesses use it all over the world, you know, billions of times a day. But Phil, I have to tell you, the presence and the ease of putting crazy things out on social media, you know, be it Twitter or Facebook or YouTube or Instagram or WeChat or all these things, you know, Phil, the propensity now of dumb people to put out some really dumb stuff and to really, and I'm sorry to have to say it this way, dumb down society. I mean, that contributed to this as well. And it still frightens me.
It is frightening. And I think if we look back through history, now social media is something that is a very pervasive aspect of our own society. And if you look back through history, even if you go back as far as Shay's Rebellion, you'll find other types of media that were very pervasive within their society that actually led up to something like a rebellion over in Springfield because they didn't agree with the taxes. But if you take something like Shay's Rebellion and you examine that in the context of that period and try to understand, you know, we just finished an American Revolution. Why are we still fighting? But if you go back and look at it, you'll realize that what came out of that revolution wasn't working. And Shay's Rebellion let us know that. So moving forward, we had to frame the Constitution. So I think a good question for historians that you know we are going to have to grapple with moving forward is, where does the event that happened last year fit into that historical narrative? And what does it tell us about the times we live in? And I think exactly what you just said fits into that analysis, understanding how that media plays a role in shaping the perceptions of the people and contributing to events.
Phil Gadudi, adjunct, assistant professor of history at Quinnipiac University in Hamden. Phil, good to speak with you. Thank you. We'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Phil Gadudi, adjunct, assistant professor of history at Quinnipiac University.